Good morning. Thanks for tuning in to KHNS Haines, Skagway, and Clutquan, and welcome to Lynn Canal Voice, a chance for the KHNS news team to take a deeper look into the pressing issues of the day in the Upper Lynn Canal. Today's show is divided into two segments. First, we'll hear from KHNS reporter Mike Swayze and Skagway Borough Manager Brad Ryan as they take an in-depth look at Skagway infrastructure challenges. Then KHNS reporter Alain de Premenil hosts a roundtable discussion of Haines housing needs with Sale Assistant Director Sierra Jimenez and Haines Borough Planner and Housing Working Group member Dave Long. A reminder that remarks made during this program reflect the personal views of the commentators and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoint of Lynn Canal Broadcasting, the Board of Directors, or staff. This Lynn Canal Voice program will be archived in its entirety at khns.org under the News tab and on the main page. If you'd like to contribute to our news fund drive during this program, please visit khns.org or call 907-766-2020 or 983-2853. And starting off this morning, Mike Swayze interviewing Skagway Borough Manager Brad Ryan.
I'm with Borough Manager Brad Ryan, and we're going to talk today about Skagway's soon-to-be municipally run port. Brad, let's start on the hillside. How is rock slide mitigation going?
It appears to be going well. We've had rock supremacy here for the last about a month and a half, I believe. They've been up there doing a lot of rock scaling. The last time I asked them, they'd brought down about 6,000 yards of material, they estimated, in addition to the 6,000 that came down on the September slide. So that's a good chunk of material that's down. If you had been up there before they started the scaling and now, it looks a lot different. It looks better. It appears to be benched, and some of the hanging hazards have been removed or sent down the chute. So it appears to be going well.
And so this is mitigation that they're doing, but it's only on that south slide area, which is on the north end of the railroad dock. This has nothing to do with anything from there further south, like that one big slide that they had that damaged the railroad dock last summer. And it doesn't have anything to do with the north chute of that slide area. It's just that main slide area that we can see from pretty much anywhere on the port, correct?
Correct. It's the south chute of the north slide is what we call it. And then there is you're referring to, I believe it was June 23rd, the rock, the large rock that dropped on the dock last summer. That has not been the focus of this effort.
Right. And neither has the large monolith rock that kind of got us going with this project. If I'm not mistaken, the idea that big rock and others like it are moving away from the top of the mountain at an increasing rate is kind of what precipitated a lot of this project. But that's not the focus of this. So what's the long-term plan to mitigate problems from that big monolith rock?
Well, I would say it's mildly the focus of this in the sense that there has been material removed from behind it and even off of it. But you're right. It's not, the focus is not to take down what we refer to as ship rock. It looks like the bow of a ship. And that did get people excited when the speed of it moving appeared to be increasing. The long-term plan would be to bring that rock down. So eventually we would like to go up there and take it down a foot or a meter at a time and eliminate that hazard altogether. In the short term, we don't want to take it down because there's a large rock field behind it that's loose rock, and we don't want to take it down and then have to deal with the rocks that it actually appears to kind of be holding together up there. So that's what they've been working on, is that rock field behind it that's smaller. Smaller rocks, more material. And then also to watch the movement of the rock, we're going to be installing a laser system, which is a total station with prisms that we would put up there on the rock so that we have a real-time monitoring down below. We'll have it mounted down here physically in the port to watch the movement of ship rock, as we refer to it. Hopefully there's another rock we call shark fin up there that's kind of behind it. And other areas, so that if it does start to move, we'll have a good indication in addition, we'll maintain what White Pass has done in the past, which is put up tilt meters to see if the rock's tilting, as well as extensometers, which are long wires that are tagged in, and as they stretch, there's a measurement on that. So some redundancy in monitoring the whole rock field up there.
Okay. And then there's, you know, on that north slope, there's an historic slide just to the north of the south slope of the major slide. And, you know, in the past, I've gone up and wandered around up there, and it's like a big old Jenga game, but with giant rocks. So is this going to be an ongoing project with the municipality for many years to come?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a project that we as a municipality, the cruise ship industry, White Pass, all need to work together on to protect, you know, life and safety of citizens and the cruise passengers when they come to town. So I don't think that we can say, oh, we've done some work this year and just wash our hands of it. The intent at this point, at least from my perspective, and, you know, cruise ships and White Pass, I think we're all having good conversations, is let's go up, put the proper protection measures in there this year, and it's going to be a continued effort until it's either totally mitigated or it'll just be an ongoing perpetual mitigation project. And I don't see that as a negative if we have to do this year after year, because the docks are so valuable to the community. What we need to do, though, is make sure that we are always engaged with it, understanding what's happening up there, and continually monitoring and doing, you know, installing, you know, protective measures and mitigation efforts until it's either totally mitigated or we just do this perpetually, like a maintenance project in the long run.
So these are municipal rocks falling on a private entity's dock, a private business's dock. Is it tricky trying to find, let's say, federal funding to help with this project?
Yeah, I think it's tricky to find federal funding, although I know the current grant that we're applying for wants private partners, and White Pass has, you know, provided us an MOA for that, and they have already put in money and time to help mitigate this project. So while it's tricky on some levels, it might actually be a bonus to some grant applications. You never know. Any project of this side to get federal funds for a small town like this is going to be tricky.
The MOA with White Pass, that's a memorandum of agreement. That means you guys have struck a deal to deal with, you know, this entire issue. Does it hold the municipality partially responsible for damage done to the White Pass dock, the railroad dock?
It does not. It's really an agreement to work collaboratively towards protecting the docks and the people down there.
Okay. Moving on, the 2023 short-term, quote-unquote, emergency plan to get a large ship at the ore dock didn't happen. There were problems with the cruise ship companies saying, "Yeah, we don't like the simulation. We're not gonna dock there." So y'all scrapped the plan. The long-term plan to redevelop the ore dock to allow both a cruise ship and barges in at the same time. Is that still a go?
It is. We're moving forward with that project. We got a lot of good feedback from the cruise lines, even though it didn't necessarily resonate with the community or the whole assembly. Initially, what we did find out is we really need to go further out into the canal with some bigger, more robust and more expensive dolphins so that there's more room for the ships to be at port. So what they really don't want is that big wing of the large ships up inside and next to a ship on Broadway. So we want to get them out there further so they don't have those big wings hanging out and that clearance gets really tight. So that's what we're moving forward with. We're going to 60%. We plan on having a public presentation of it here in town. I believe it's going to be February 6th, tentatively scheduled right now, or maybe the 7th. And then we'll go to Port Harbor afterward and the assembly. It's moving forward. We got a lot of engagement. We want to continue to have a lot of engagement on it. And I really like the idea that we're going further out because it also gets us an extra 200 feet up inside the industrial port. It gives us more room to do other activities up in there. So I think in the long run, it'll be a better project. It's going to cost us more, but I think it's worth it.
How much more?
Oh, man, I don't know the dollar mark yet how much more. And things continue to increase in price, so it's really hard to decide when you are, which stage of the project you're comparing it to. You know, 6 months ago, a year ago, or 3 months ago. Everything is creeping up, as we all know.
So I guess another way to attack that would be, how long before we run through that $65 million revenue bond?
I believe if we're just talking about the cruise ship dock, we should have plenty of money within that $65 million revenue bond. If you want to build the cruise ship dock and the roll-on, roll-off, then we're going to have to look at that more tightly. But we're still waiting on bids. And then there's another consideration in that originally we had talked about dredging the inside to get more room. And we haven't reassessed whether that's still necessary or not. We're still moving forward with the permitting, but I don't know if that's going to eliminate some of the need to do a lot of that dredging that was, you know, another $20 million or so up inside for that.
Okay. Any word on whether Ada is going to come and take down their ship loader and the ore house down there? Is that something that Ada is going to do?
I can't tell you what Ada is going to do. I can't represent them, but my interpretation is no, they're not going to come take down anything. The last report I saw to the board was to just leave it in place. They don't want to invest in it, and they don't want it. We actually have the mayor and Deputy Deitch up in Anchorage right now, and they're going to have a meeting. Well, I think I'm going to attend virtually a meeting with Ada today to ask some of those questions. Like, can you give us more intent, you know, more specifics on what your intent is, you know, with the facility, and also ask them for money to help demo it. So, you know, they have a new leader and, you know, like Alan Weissner has left the organization. So now there's new leadership and we don't know what that relationship's going to look like. We've asked them to come down and do an on-site walkthrough. Two of their representatives said they would. I hope they do.
Okay. So it's possible that we might get some funding from Ada to help remove some of that infrastructure. A couple more quick...
I would say very slim, but we're asking. I can tell you that.
Well, it doesn't hurt to ask, I guess. A couple other quick questions. One, putting dolphins further out into the bay, does that then allow the Quantum or post-Panamax size cruise ship to dock at the Aurora dock in the future?
Oh, absolutely. That's the entire intent of this. If it didn't, there'd be no reason to do the project.
Okay, so you could get the large post-Panamax size ship there and fuel barges. There was some concern with Petromarine that they were going to have to start using skiffs to bring their fuel barge in. Is that something that's been addressed?
That was over the alternative mooring plan. So we're not implementing that anymore. So now we have to go back and start looking at it again. The long-term plan is not for them to have to use skiffs to go tie up their fuel barges. But that was the short-term, one-year fix for this alternative mooring plan that we're not doing.
Just taking a quick break to remind you that you're tuned in to KHNS Haines, Skagway, and Klukwan. We're in the middle of our Lynn Canal Voice program this morning as we're taking a deeper look into the pressing issues of the Upper Lynn Canal, including Skagway infrastructure challenges and housing needs in Haines. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to donate to our KHNS News Drive, visit khns.org or call us at 907-766-2020 or 983-2853. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll return to Mike Swayze and Skagway Borough Manager Brad Ryan.
Let's move on a little bit. The DOT, the Alaska Department of Transportation, and the municipality agreed to fund initial designs in an effort to move the state ferry terminal over to the Ore Dock, or at least the Ore Peninsula. How do you envision that happening, and what's a likely timeline for that if it does?
Well, I guess the first step, so we've had a lot of conversations since I've been here about, you know, either getting access and building a joint use dock off the ferry peninsula for cruise ships, or going to the Ore Peninsula and then with the ferry terminal and then using the Ferry Peninsula for cruise ships. That's gone round and round for the 3 years I've been here, and I know these discussions were happening before me. We were back and forth a lot, and then but it never went anywhere. So we finally asked DOT to show some commitment if they want to move. They came to town to show that commitment. We walked everything. They liked the Ore Peninsula. So we then said, well, if you like it, how do you show your commitment again? Because the municipality has over and over again put up match and matching funds for design, for the federal funds for the ferry float. So what is DOT going to do to show their commitment? And their idea was to fund half of, 50% of the conceptual design of a ferry terminal going to the Ore Peninsula. So we now, as the municipality, have to put up the other half. And I believe we're each in it $100,000. We just need to execute a contract with an engineering firm to start drawing up those conceptual designs, and then work through that with the DOT to see if they're going to work out and they're going to agree to something going to the Ore Peninsula. There's been a lot of discussions about dock configurations and how they may look and whether they would come in berth or side berth. We don't know that answer yet, but we need to get there. But DOT does seem to think that they can bring their boats over there at this point. And so we just need to get some conceptual designs that their captains will sign off on.
Will that take up the entire peninsula? And what I'm getting at here is, what happens to Temsco if the Ore Peninsula becomes a state ferry peninsula?
Yep. We have been told by DOT very clearly that the helicopters cannot be there, so Temsco would have to move.
And is that something that the municipality plans to help Temsco with in the event that this all happens, or is it not necessarily the municipality's purview to help them find a new location?
Yeah, I can't say that we are committed to helping them find a new location. Not that, you know, we wouldn't try to work with them, but I don't know that it would be within our purview to do that. It's a long way out, too. You asked the time frame. I think we would be moving at lightning speed if we could put a ferry terminal on the Ore Peninsula in 5 years. You know, that's not, I know that myself and their engineer, you know, DOT's engineer, both agreed. The management people were pretty excited to do this, and we both kind of rained on their parade a little bit when we said, you know, at best, this is 5 years out. You know, I think there was a lot of hope that this could happen in a year. And like, there's just no way that's going to happen. So, you know, I think Temsco has a 5-year window to be down there pretty easily. I guess there's always an outside chance it happens faster than that, but it seems really unlikely.
Well, staying with the DOT, there was some talk between the DOT and the municipality about having the municipality take over the airport. Where does that sit now?
There's been a bunch of talk about that, actually. The first time it happened, we just flat out said no. They sent us a letter, probably a year ago now, offering to give us the airport and the Ferry Peninsula and State Street. And that would have freed up everything, but we'd had to take on all of it. We did not want to do that. Now there's this new talk of, do we want to take on the airport? They've sent us some details, but it really hasn't gone far. DOT would, of course, give us the airport in a heartbeat. I just don't know that we as a municipality right now have the capacity to go take on another large project like that. So it hasn't really risen to the top of trying to sort out what that might look like.
And if that doesn't happen, then is the deal with Seaplanes that was offered, is that something that will likely move forward?
Oh, I think that'll move forward. That's just a lease of the building. It's not the airport. You know, DOT wants to give us the airport. That would be it. That's just Seaplanes having the building.
Having the building itself. Okay. Well, I've saved the best for last, Brad. Remediation. The municipality made an agreement with White Pass to take over remediation of the harbor, for up to $15 million. In that way, the White Pass would leave its infrastructure there, and then, you know, the municipality takes over cleanup of the harbor. Again, that cap at $15 million means somewhere down the line, if costs overrun that, then White Pass comes back in and helps pay for the rest of the remediation of the contamination in the ore basin. So what is the municipality's plan to start cleanup down there or continue cleanup?
Yeah. So it was one that's specifically related to the ore contamination, right? Not say fuel spills or things like that.
Right.
Or, you know, other things. So that's one thing that we need to clarify. I don't think our plans change at all, because from the start with the ore peninsula upgrades, with the utility designs that we have that we're digging in there, we as staff have always recommended the same plan. And that is every time we touch contaminated material, we want to send it out of town. We don't want to stockpile it. We don't want to put it in concrete behind the sheet pile wall. We've been budgeted to do that within our projects from the start. So for example, all the dredging in the ore basin that we would do, we estimated that dredging to cost us $300 a yard to remove because we were making the assumption it was contaminated. If it's not contaminated and we can dispose of it locally, that's $60 a yard. That's the cost estimates, right? So I don't think a lot changes because every time we're going to touch it, we want to send that material out so that we don't have to deal with it again. We're digging utilities in down there. It's the same thing. We know we're going to dig through areas that are contaminated with lead. They've been capped. They are DEC sites. But when we get in there and we trench this out, I have no intention of recommending that material that's hot with lead to put it back in the trench. Even though I know we can do that, DEC lets us do that. That I don't think that's a good practice. I think we need to send it out of town so the next time one of our crew has to dig in there, they can be assured that we put clean fill in there. We'll still have to have protections in place, but every time we get a chance, we should be cleaning it up. And that, to me, is one of the bonuses to the municipality taking over this is Skagway has been very good about cleaning up their sites as soon as they get a chance. You know, the clinic site we've been monitoring for a long time. Even when we went to sell the lots on Fifth Avenue, there was some debate on whether we should do a phase one environmental before we sold it. To my happiness, the assembly agreed and said, yes, we should do a phase one before we sell lots because we don't want to sell contaminated lots. We don't want the community to have to deal with that. And sure enough, it's contaminated. So we're not selling it until we clean it up. And we continue to do that. So I see this as a positive. I think we're going to clean it up right. And we're going to do everything we can to go above and beyond as opposed to what's allowed by the law.
One of the big question marks in the remediation project is how much contamination is underneath the timber dock. And so is that going to be then removed as part of this project?
The timber dock will be removed, yes. But I think it's really less of what's under the timber dock and what's under the ore loader, right? Which has that concrete platform on it. But yeah, that'll get removed and that'll give us an opportunity anytime we need to touch that material to do the proper sampling and know what's there so that we can clean it up.
And how long do you think before remediation is complete on the ore peninsula or off of the ore peninsula?
I doubt that remediation will ever be totally complete on there, right? I mean, that is especially my experience and understanding of lead contaminated sites is you try not to disturb them because when you disturb them, quite often you can cause more harm. So you clean them up as you have to work in them. For example, if we have to dredge for the floating dock, we would do some sampling, characterize the sediment that's down there, and then clean it up. We're doing that on the north end in the ore basin right now. We have a design to go out and drill the north end material in the ore basin, even though we don't believe it's contaminated because it's a lot of native material up there. We're still going to drill it so that we can characterize what is in the ore basin before we do any dredging in the north end. I'm reasonably positive it's going to be clean, but I don't want to make that guess, right? We need to do that beforehand. And that was always one of our big complaints. We always wanted a lot more sampling. And so now we have the opportunity to sample before and after so we know what's in there.
So if this is all, if all of the cost of this is being put into the, you know, the Ore Peninsula Revitalization Project, how do you reach that number of $15 million as an agreement for how much the municipality is going to spend on that, you know, that agreement that you made with White Pass? How do you approach that $15 million target? Is there a separate accounting system just for removal of contaminated material?
It's going to be hard. You know, we're going to have to keep an accounting of how much material really was contaminated, say, for dredging, and we disposed of it at $300 a yard versus how much we disposed of at $60 a yard, for example, that wasn't. And we're just going to have to keep a running accounting spreadsheet of that. But it's not going to be simple, right? And there'll be a bunch of debate on it. But absolutely, it's going to be a... It's going to be an accounting or a bookkeeping issue.
Okay, and the final question I've got is, when do we expect to have a post-Panamax size cruise ship at Ore Peninsula?
If everything goes well, in the spring of 24.
So that's a very fast timeline. That's incredible. Broadway stays the same at this point, and then if you move the Broadway, or if you move the State Ferry Peninsula over to the Ore Peninsula, then will there be of the possibility of development down there on the Broadway Peninsula?
Yeah, I mean, the intent would be if we can move the ferry peninsula or the ferry terminal to the Ore, is then to develop the ferry peninsula into a cruise ship facility.
Borough Manager Brad Ryan, thank you so much for taking the time and hanging out with us. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to KHNS Haines, Skagway, and Clukwan. That was Skagway reporter Mike Swayze speaking with Skagway Borough Manager Brad Ryan about infrastructure challenges along the Skagway waterfront. Thanks for tuning in to Link Canal Voice this morning. It's the KHNS News Drive. If you'd like to donate to the KHNS News, visit our website at khns.org or give us a call at 766-2020 or 983-2853. We'll continue this segment for the second half of the hour with Alain de Premenil and SAIL Assistant Director Sierra Jimenez and Hainesboro Planner and Housing Working Group member Dave Long. There is a slight audio gap here at the beginning, just after Alain's question to Sierra about the Section 8 housing vouchers.
A lot of people don't qualify for subsidized housing. You know, there's lots of issues.
Dave, what is your take on the housing shortage? How do you see that going through in your job?
Across the board, I think that the housing working group meetings, we've had several, and we plan to have continue these through the year in 2023 to keep. It's a long-term project to make changes, and so. I think that what we learned is there's a lack of diversity of rentals, especially. Not everybody wants to own a house. Mm-hmm. Rentals are a tight market. There's the types of them that are available. Obviously, when prices went high, all the available properties kind of went down. The overall inventory of rentals and sales has been fairly low. So that makes it challenging if there's not a lot of available housing. We need to produce more housing, additional housing, that means.
Are there any roadblocks that could be lifted, maybe in borough code or, you know, tweaking the tax structures to encourage additional housing or maybe apartment buildings being built?
Yes, and we took that on. If anything we've accomplished so far in the housing working group is we put together a developer.
Sorry, Dave, real quick. Can you just use that mic for a second? I'm sorry, we have a little mic issue.
Here we go. Yeah, we actually, the housing working group, put into place a deferred tax incentive for developing additional housing, and we have one developer that's been approved for that. It's basically if somebody wants to provide housing or lots that would be able to be built to provide more housing in the sake of economic development, you could have a 5 or 10 year tax deferment of an increase in the taxes on the new lots that are created or on the multi-unit you build. Maybe there's a 2 or 3 year deferred tax amount. You pay what the taxes are today, but not until you sell a unit is the way it works for the one subdivision that's been approved.
Is that the Hilltop subdivision?
The Hilltop subdivision, and that's one of our new opportunities for folks to get out and build their own place. There's not a great available inventory of lots of new subdivision types. Subdivisions in the past took 10 to 15 to 20 years to sell all the lots in. There's not been a lot of incentive for a developer to go make a subdivision and then get taxed at the highest level for these lots, and then they can't sell them. So we have seen a shortage of new lots being created probably in the last 10 or 15 years, and that reflects the national trend of just more housing units haven't been created at a fast enough pace to keep up with the demand. COVID brought people and interest to Haines that further stressed the issue. We're challenged by workforce, transportation of goods, prices and costs. And there's a lot of challenges, but the tax incentive hopefully is going to spur some development. Those all benefit the borough and increase property tax revenue overall while providing housing.
Has there been an incentive for the developer to make smaller lots that would be the kind that first-time buyers would be interested in?
Well, that's interesting because a lot of first-time buyers say they want a larger lot with a dry cabin. So it's not always, and that's absolutely what we've heard in the housing working group is folks want to go kind of chip away at it, build a cabin, maybe someday it becomes a house. I think I ran that route with my wife a long time ago, a cabin added on, right. Small loans and out of pocket is how some people have to do it if your income is going to be limited, which Haines has a lower trend of wages than a lot of the other areas and similar communities in the state. So it's a challenge to afford living here based on the type of job you can have and how much of a mortgage you can afford. So as we look at the subdivision potential for the Haines Borough out at the Mount Riley parcels, we have about 100 or 120 acres of, I believe, developable lots out there. I envision maybe there's a diversity of lot size, an acre and a half, acre and a third, to allow for the private on-site utilities. And that's probably going to be the deal breaker of affordability on that housing potential subdivision that the borough would do, is if we bring the water and sewer there, it's going to double or triple the price of each lot. So is that affordable? Is that helping? I'm not sure. Maybe we need to listen more to the community concerns, and the desire to have dry cabins on 2 or 4 acre lots might be more affordable per folks that want to go do that. And there's still a frontier spirit. People like building their own thing. We're working with HEDC on a couple items. The housing survey will be coming out, and that's going to get us a lot of great information on what people want and their vision is for Haines. And we're going to ask specific questions of how do you want the subdivision to be? You know, what can the borough do? What can other entities do? So we're going out on a gather information right now to help push more of these things. And you mentioned tax incentives, but there's also the other call to duty for governments is to look at restrictive zoning and permitting are nationally the problem that hampers development of new housing. We don't have a permitting and strict and expensive building permit system. That's not the way that we need to approach it. We need to look at maybe increasing areas that have zoning for multi-housing units. That's pretty restricted in our zoning. And or look at letting people add additional secondary housing units on a lot. That's called an accessory dwelling unit. And a lot of communities have gone to that. They can keep a senior living with a family in basically a mother-in-law and apartment is what we allow now. It's called an accessory apartment up to 600 square feet. It must be attached to the house or garage. So this ADU, it's called, could be an alternate structure that's standalone out in the yard, a little cabin or something.
Okay. Sierra, do you know what other communities have done around the state to address housing shortages?
Sitka is really interesting. They have a couple different things, but one thing that SAIL's involved in Sitka is it's tiny homes for a lot, and it's primarily for actually men that are homeless. And there's a big working group really pushing that forward. I think Dave was right on the desire for, like, dry cabins, just shelter. I mean, really. Right. And like I said, being part of this housing working group has been a real eye-opener for me, because I come with one lens, which is people with limited income just trying to find shelter. But the need is broad across the spectrum. And so it's been fascinating for me to kind of hear what the, you know, young people trying to make it in Haines with good, you know, with incomes, with jobs, and struggling, to seniors who have lived here comfortably for, you know, 50 years, and all of a sudden now they can't afford the home that they have had forever, or the apartment that they've been in for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So it's a really broad spectrum.
So what does it look like in Sitka? They have lots dedicated where people can just drive a trailer or a tiny house on it? And
I don't know the specifics. I we've got staff in Sitka that are part of the working group, and I just heard, you know, here's what they're doing. But the idea is just, it's a homeless population primarily, mm-hmm. and I don't know the specifics, so I can't talk to it about it. Do you?
Dave
might.
No, but there's another program in Sitka. It's called the Community Land Trust. And yes. In that situation, the municipality donated parcel of land to a nonprofit corporation, which was a housing entity. It wouldn't be something driven directly by the government, but a nonprofit would be formed. They received a Rasmussen Grant Foundation grant to develop the sites, and then later homeowners were able to build or purchase existing homes that are forever subject to low and medium income housing qualifications. The homeowners retain 99-year leases on their structures for the one larger parcel of land that's owned by the trust. Then some studies are saying that percentage of land cost to build a home and have a dwelling is a big factor. If you're just buying the land, costs more than proportionate to the cost of the residential improvement, then it gets off balance. And that's been a barrier for people to build and own, as actually the land is too expensive, and especially in a place like Sitka. Mm-hmm. So I did examine that. The Haynesborough ownership does not include a lot of good multi-residential property. In fact, there was hardly any. So I didn't find that we own that property to donate or provide, but I certainly did look into it, because that's an idea. We're still pursuing those types of things with the housing group.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's really apparent when you walk around Haines is that the downtown area is pretty sparse, and there's a lot of open space. Is there anything we could do?
Absolutely. That's called infilling. And one of the greatest things the community can do is encourage people to build those vacant lots that are within the town site that already exists. They don't need to be subdivided. The challenge, again, in Haines, we're on the verge of being a small city in a large village. And it's reflected sometimes in our infrastructure. Our water and sewer don't reach to all neighborhoods equally. And some of those lots that haven't developed maybe have a gigantic development cost to bring, say, water. Borough code requires that you have to bring water and sewer if it's within 200 feet of your lot. And in a couple situations, people have made the decision not to go develop or purchase that lot because of the development costs to develop the road to borough standards and bring the public utilities in. Those, when you do a utility extension, it's a main extension. It requires engineering and DEC approvals. It's a long timeline. My last estimate I heard on installing new water line is approaching $400 a linear foot. And that number's staggering.
That is
enormous. And it must have doubled in the last couple of years. And so if we continue to have high building cost prices and workforce pricing, it's always going to be a challenge in Haines. And that's why I have promoted the theme that we need to create additional housing, not affordable housing, because it's hard to justify many things are truly affordable in Haines if you look around and compare our rates to similar communities. We have some challenges there.
Now, a friend in my neighborhood was telling me how, you know, she's got a nice little cabin on an acre, and, you know, she's looking as she ages that, you know, shoveling the driveway and doing all these physical things that we all have to do to maintain a house might become too much. And if there was some apartment units downtown, you know, it would kind of like the senior village, but you know, for a more general public, it would be really attractive to her.
I think that'll continue to be a trend. We have a elder population, one of the most senior populations in the state, and we're going to continue to have folks that want to stay here, and living will be harder to do all those things on your own. Maybe the accessory dwelling is nice. So you have a tenant that you rent the cabin to, and they help you along. Or in my idea, this would keep families together. Mm-hmm. It's a trend across the nation to have seniors live with the nuclear family. I like that term. Mm-hmm. It sounds dangerous, but that's what's in the housing survey. Are you a part of a nuclear family? Well, at times.
2.5 children.
2.5 to 2.7. Yeah, who's the 0.5 of the children? That's always the troublemaker. So I think it's important to keep families together. That's why people choose to live here is one of the main reasons I've seen in my 30-some years here that people move away is to go be closer to family down south.
Right.
Medical and go be closer to family down south are real trends of why are out migration that maybe we can help.
Yeah.
Well, this seems like a good chance to take a quick break right here and get a drink of water, and then we'll be back in just a minute with some more Lynn Canal Voice. Thanks to Sierra Jimenez, Dave Long, and Alan de Premenil for conducting this. We'll be right back. Stay tuned and stay listening. Thanks for tuning in to KHNS. If you're just joining us, we are in the last little bit of our hour-long news magazine program, Lynn Canal Voice, as we explore some of the pressing issues in the Upper Lynn Canal. And for this segment, we're joined by Dave Long and Sierra Jimenez from the Haines Housing Working Group. And good morning again. And we were in our discussion. Continues.
Good morning. The next question I had for Sierra is there are nationally some voucher and housing assistance.
Housing voucher program.
Could you tell us about that and what's available in Haines? Oh,
I can speak to it. Yes, through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, it's called the Housing Voucher Choice, I think. I might have that wrong. Also often known as Section 8, and which subsidized housing in a person. It's a great program. It is not available in Haines.
Oh.
Yep.
What would it take to get that available?
I wish I knew. And it's something that we have been talking about, and it's come up at the housing working group, too, to say what's it going to take? Who do we advocate? Why can't we, you know, communities like Petersburg have it available? You know, yes, of course, it's in Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, you know, the larger communities. But there are smaller communities all throughout Alaska that have Section 8 or housing voucher programs. And I think that would be... it would be a huge help here for people with low income.
It would probably be a big motivation factor for people who do have spare cabins to open them up.
Right,
to
guaranteed rent.
Low-income people who they might have a question whether they're going to be able to come up with rent.
Right, absolutely.
So it could increase their housing stock.
It seems to me, I know there's, you know, always some hoops to jump, but a win-win for both, you know, people who are struggling here to afford housing and for landlords to have guaranteed rent.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of those units right now are being used for short-term rentals. Dave, is that something you've seen explode in the last five years?
And a concern of some folks in there, because there's been a trend nationally of Airbnb type short-term rentals, we call them less than 30-day rentals, that don't allow somebody to live there for a long period of time. They're treated like a resort property, like instead of, there's been a trend of staying in vacation rentals more than in hotels and motels. And so I studied this, and what I found was we had 47 active vacation rental permits. This was in April of 2022. Of the 47 active permits, 3 are hotels, the Captain's Choice Hotel, the Hotel Helsingland, and the Aspen. The rest are residential dwellings with 1 to 4 rooms each. They're spread out pretty equally around the valley. I think to note, there's been a shift that we'd lost 3 hotels, basically, is what we've realized. The Mountain View Hotel, the Eagle's Nest, and the Thunderbird Hotel have all been transformed into long-term rentals, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't just go away. They became long-term housing, and so it kind of pushed the market over towards the vacation rentals. There's not more rooms in vacation rental. It's probably about equal, but it appears there's just been a shift of what people's choices are. Now, the complaints down south based around these a lot are there's too many in one neighborhood, the party rules, what they take away from normal working people's housing for the community. We didn't really find that to be a significant factor in Haines overall of our 1,600 plus or minus housing units that only half are occupied probably all year, whether they're seasonal residents. You know, we've had a commissioner and housing working group member, Rob Goldberg, absolutely wanted to contact people and ask them if they would consider renting their vacant property. And people have reasons why they would want to and would not want to in a long-term rental process. And we have that question in our housing survey we're working on with the Haines Economic Development Corporation. So we're going to ask people, would you consider it?
Have you heard preliminary responses on the reason why people wouldn't want to rent?
No, but just the basic reality is a lot of people like their private one bedroom or one residence property. It's been a trend in the Americas since the early 1900s. The goal is to have your own house on your own property. Mm-hmm. And it's not been a good trend for diversity of housing at all, but it is what it is. Some of those people don't want to rent their house. They have their art and their clothes and their whatever guns in there. They don't want a renter or a tenant in there. They want to come back in April, you know, to be a full-time resident in Alaska. You have to be here a little over 6 months. There are some of those people, especially with our age and retirement statistics in our community. Some of those people are able to go away for 4 or 5 months. They don't want to rent it for 4 or 5 months. You have increased snowplow, heating costs, just all the disasters that can happen in the winter are amplified of water lines freezing. Right. There's a lot of reasons, but maybe what if we could grab 20 of those people? Maybe that would help. And that's the idea. We're just going to go ahead and I think the survey is the best way to ask that probably.
And just even like people listening now, you know, that have that, that maybe hadn't realized what a shortage of housing there is and love this community and are like, wow, maybe I could, you know, I think it takes a while to come around to the idea of you've never had a renter in your house, but you're not here for 6 months. So even if one or two people just start thinking about it, like what if it would be a huge benefit to the community.
And I think the hold up there was we couldn't figure out what the incentive is to make people want to do that. It's got to come from within, I think, especially when you compare the short-term versus long-term renters. Right. There's a much bigger profit to be made in renting your room for $150 a night than $450 a month, say. But you also, I see that the vacation rentals create an industry. They create people to work on the building. They shovel the snow. Somebody cleans the unit. It creates its own little industry. And the borough right now with a 4% lodging bed tax, this year it's projected in 23 to bring in $128,000 to our general fund. I mean, that's a good contribution to overall Haines budget. So there's a place for vacation rentals. We'll continue to keep an eye on it and see, you know, some people like to limit them. The conversations haven't gone that way. They've said no, they actually haven't had the impact since we lost all the hotels. And so that's, I think that's my take on where it currently sits.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. It's been a wonderful conversation. Obviously, it could go on for a lot longer.
There was that good cup of coffee and snacks out in the
Thanks
lobby.
Thanks for talking about it. I mean, I really think that that's the main thing as a community that we need to recognize, the across the board, that there is a housing crisis in Haines and that conversations like this are what helps move the needle.
Exactly.
And I think workforce, whatever we can do to encourage our workforce to develop and have our own workers here to build houses is going to help keep costs down overall. Mm-hmm. So there's so many things tied to housing.
Yeah.
I think everything.
Everything's tied to housing. Yeah.
And then for the housing working group, so those that meets regularly, is there a way for people to get in touch with the working group or submit comments?
You can always get in touch through me at the Haines Borough as the planner, but the mayor leads that group, and we will set a meeting date probably here after the first of the year. We're on standard. Lots of people are traveling this month, so we're just going to pick that up after the first of the year, and we'll advertise it on the Haines Borough website. And feel free to get in touch with me at 766-6412 at the Haines Borough.
Awesome. Thanks, Dave. And thanks, Sierra. And thanks, Alan.
Thank you, Marley.
Yes. And thank you, listener, for tuning in to KHNS Haines Skagway and Klukwan. It's just about 11 o'clock, and we'll have the World Cafe with some fundraising segments coming up next. It is the middle of our KHNS news drive, so be sure to call in 766-2020 or 983-2853 or online at khns.org. Thanks again to Sierra Jimenez and Dave Long for joining us this morning, and thanks again to Brad Ryan for joining Mike for our extended interview on Skagway infrastructure. Again, we'll have this entire segment, both of those segments, posted on our website in just a few minutes. We are wrapping up here. Thanks again for tuning in to KHNS Haines Skagway and Klukwan. Thank you, thank you, thank you.